back to the UCB Long Forum Conversations podcast. Mm-hmm. Sitting across from me is Will Hines.
Yeah, that's right. And conversely, sitting across from me is John Frusciante. Hello, John.
Hello, Will. How are you?
I'm all right.
With us today is, of course, podcast intern Sypha Sounds.
Good evening.
Hello, Sypha.
Sypha Sounds.
Hello.
Just returned from a long whirlwind tour of Italy.
Yeah.
How was that?
It was excellent.
Sounds great.
Had a lot of fun.
You rode a Segway, yes?
Yep. I went on a Segway tour of Rome. I suggest you do it. RexTours.com.
RexTours is our sponsor this week.
Yeah, Rex. Yeah. A German man named Leo ran the tour. It was cool.
All right. Uh-huh. That sounds fun.
Okay, great.
Went to the Jewish ghetto.
Nice.
Really?
He said he had to explain to Americans when he says, we're going to visit the ghetto.
Yeah.
No, not that.
Right. Uh-huh. Well, you have a different association, you Americans.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And, of course, podcast intern, off mic, Keaton Patty.
Well, there's only four channels on the mixer.
We can't give him a microphone.
It's not a judgment thing. It's just plug at four.
Yeah,
so
I'll figure this out.
We were discussing before the podcast started Keaton's whirlwind rise to cult status on this podcast.
But, Keaton, shout hello from off mic.
Hey, guys. Thanks for having
me. That pick up at all, Sypha?
I don't know. I can't hear it.
Couldn't hear that he said thanks for having I? You couldn't hear that at all? Because that was the thing that was said.
Mark this down to edit. Hold on. Okay.
Someday Keaton will take over.
I hope so.
Yep.
Will.
Yes, John.
I have a question for you.
Okay.
This is slightly improv related.
Okay.
Who's our guest this week?
Our guest is sitting directly to your left.
Oh, I can't turn my head.
I'm going to give you only his first name.
Philosophical reasons prevent me from turning my head, not physical reasons.
Go ahead. Have an emotional strategy that prevents you from
Yeah, I've decided just to adopt a philosophy whereby I don't turn my head. I just look straight ahead.
All right.
It's kind of, yeah.
That's a great justification. You just finished your 201 level group game class?
I did,
all right.
Yeah.
Our guest today is Zubin.
I liked it.
All right. Zubin Parang. Am I saying the last name right?
Completely right, yes.
Great. Mm-hmm. Zubin.
Thanks for having me, guys. Glad to be here.
Yeah. Zubin is most known for being the subject of Jessica Stickle's ridiculous Photoshop experiments.
That's not what I want to be remembered
by. Number one claim to fame in all of comedy.
I have so many other things.
Certainly within the UCB universe is that Jessica Stickle's Photoshops your face awesomely.
That's not a fair thing to remember me by.
I would say that if you die now,
right,
the only thing I'm going to talk about,
yep,
and that you will be remembered for,
and will be the bulk of your obituary,
and will be talked about a lot, but only this,
mm-hmm,
is Jessica Stickle's Photoshops of you.
I don't dispute that's what it's going to be. I'm very disappointed by that. I wish there were other things. I'm a writer for a daily show.
That's all right.
I'm all right. That's fine.
How many years have you been associated with UCB?
I've been associated with UCB since 2007.
And when did you start doing improv down in Washington?
When I got to Washington in 2003.
So that's about 10 years of doing this comedy stuff.
Well, I also did it in college and high school even, so
you can go back
maybe
that
even,
far.
Yeah, back to 96 or so.
Okay. Yeah, Jessica Stickle's Photoshop, I think.
Yeah,
again,
the
there's
most
just so much
yeah.
that's
yeah.
there. But besides that, it's not even my own accomplishment.
No, you've got nothing
really,
to do with it.
I don't want my life to be a testament to Jessica Stickle's mm-hmm. fame.
When Will brought that
Photoshop.
Up, my ears perked up.
Yes.
And as you were talking about your history, they slowly descended.
Yeah, that's right.
Mm-hmm.
All right, let's talk about the Photoshop. There's one of me with a cupcake. It's pretty neat.
So there's a lot to talk about, Zubin, with you.
I think
today.
We should do a quick, just like to give viewers who don't know Zubin, just sort of an overall,
mm-hmm.
like first paragraph of the Wikipedia page type of navigation, just so they know what we're going to get into.
Sure.
So without getting into too much details, Zubin, I'm going to put you on the spot. Could you just quickly give me a quick sketch of like your comedy sort of career?
Mm.
Sure.
Almost like what we just did, but almost just like three times as long.
Yeah, sure. I started doing improv in high school, continued in college in short form, went to law school in D.C. and performed with the Washington Improv Theater, which has a lot of alumni from there are big UCB people now.
Right.
Yeah.
Came to UCB in 2006, got on the Herald Team Reynard in 2007,
yep.
Which I think is probably still considered one of the most disastrous Herald teams.
I think it's the
UCB.
Second worst team.
Yeah, probably.
The
yeah.
second worst team? Mm-hmm. What will be the first?
I think the Rockets is the yeah. worst, in my opinion.
I think it still holds that.
Not everybody
really?
Agrees with that. Mm-hmm. Yeah, because there was a hostility on the Rockets. And every individual in the Rockets was great, but there was a group hostility.
Mm-hmm.
There was on Reynard, too. but I think it was – I think Reynard had the best of intentions.
Yeah.
So anyway, you're on Reynard. Yeah, yes. Second worst.
I'm a little disappointed to know that it's not considered the first worst.
Maybe you'll convince me. I'm willing. I'm open to being sold down.
Yeah, I mean, I've got a lot of arguments.
You can't even be great at being the worst.
No, exactly. There's nothing at all.
You were too incapable to be the worst.
That was the one hope I had for that team. And it's gone now. It's
gone
you
now. Failed at being the biggest failure.
Yeah, sorry.
The layers of failure are so deep. And then after Reynard ended in 2008, then I was on the Bishop Herald team, which is again another failed improv team.
Although I thought a pretty good team.
A good team.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, not Reynard level. But
yeah, Will still, and I were talking about this before the podcast. I remember the Bishop as being like a capable, decent team.
Yeah.
Will had a good point about this that I will let him make.
Yeah, there was 10 Herald teams then. And it was an attempt to get more people in Herald, and it was too crowded. Like, every team only had two shows. You couldn't get coaches. And so, there was a bloodbath that took out the Bishop.
Yeah.
Kind of just like...
Took out Penthouse Riot, too. Yeah.
Yeah,
like, good performers.
Real good people. Great performers, on both teams. Mm-hmm. And the Bishop, in particular, was mostly a lot of people's first team, or people like you that hadn't been on for very long.
Yeah.
So it had, like, that kind of new enthusiasm with it. And just, like...
And that's
going
to be crushed.
It had to be crushed because that kind of hope is not allowed to survive
in
a proper improv environment.
Yeah.
But I remember good shows, like good people. Bishop was a solid team, just not solid enough to survive the shrinking of roster sizes.
That's fair. Yeah, and I would disagree with it.
Anthony King would have to be the one who's actually spoke to that, but
let's
that was
get
my
him
impression.
On here. Can we call him?
Let's call him.
Yeah, sure. I've got a lot of things I want to ask him about. but then after the Bishop, I was also on the mod team Thunder Gulch, which performed alongside with Gramps for a few months.
There you go. Thank you. Very early, very early.
Get that out there for you guys.
Thank you.
And I was on Thunder Gulch, the mod team, for a long time, and then Charlemagne, and I'm currently now on the weekend team, What I Did for Love.
Right.
Very new weekend team. Like
very
a couple
new
weeks
team.
Old, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I mean, that group's been around for a while, but newly minted as a weekend team.
Yes. That's right. The first show was 2 weeks ago, in fact.
Oh,
so.
Mm-hmm. Nice.
So there's a lot to talk about. You mentioned that you were a lawyer. What kind of lawyer were you?
I was a lawyer for like a very like typical midtown large law firm that deals mostly with commercial and civil banking insurance kind of stuff. Like we defended Allstate, we defend Prudential. Uh-huh. Whenever there's like rich people or rich companies that need to defend themselves from poor people or other rich companies, then that's our job. Uh-huh. That was our job.
So you're the enemy.
In a lot of ways, yeah. There's a lot of things. I don't want to get into too many specifics about what I did, but there's once our firm at one point helped defend Allstate from having to give out billions of dollars to Hurricane Katrina victims. Because there was a...
Do they hand out like handlebar mustaches to you guys when you start to work
there?
There's
like congratulatory
top hats
emails being sent around.
And like railroad tracks for you to tie damsels to? Did we mention that you're...
It was a lot like those letters you get when you help children in Africa where like, they explain the history, but that was for the children whose lives we destroyed.
Right.
About what we've helped do to ruin their futures.
Sorry to break the momentum of the bit, but did we mention in his comedy? Then you wrote for The Daily Show. Do we even mention that?
For The Daily Show now.
Yeah, well, I think that should be part of a comedy bio.
Yeah, definitely.
Sure,
Although, within the context of this podcast, being on a weekend team is more significant. So you're right to bring that up, but I don't think it should be left out.
Yeah, you've made more people jealous talking about being on a weekend team. how did you balance being in, like, you were very involved with UCB. You took classes. You were on a, like you said, you were on a Harold team. You were
we
on
couldn't
a,
get rid of you.
A mod team.
No,
we
I kept coming back. Yeah, I don't know.
And you were a lawyer, like a full-time lawyer with a big lawyer job. Like, how did you balance?
And you showed up on time for things.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well,
we didn't need to invoke the 15-minute rule on Jubin, even though you had real responsibilities.
I mean, because I like doing that a lot more than I like being a lawyer. So I was always, like, eager to come here. But a lot of it, what I would do is I would go to a show at, like, 8 or 9, leave at 11, then go back to the law firm for, like, 3 or 4 more hours. So then I'd go home around, like, 4, come back to work around, like, 9. It was a very exhausting time of my life, like, very physically. I just had a lot of coffee. I had a lot of 5-hour energy, a lot of no-dos.
Yeah.
But that's just, I wanted to do comedy more than I wanted to be a lawyer, which finally, like, left me to leave the law firm path. But, yeah, in the meantime, it was a lot of trying to convince myself that I was just doing this for a hobby and that I didn't really want to do this for a career.
Right.
Lawyering.
Actually, I was like telling myself, like, no, comedy is just for fun. Although I'm kind of treating it like I want it to be my job.
Right.
And so in that, in those, like, that 4 years, it was just a lot of doing, of not getting any sleep, basically.
What was the thing that led, like, how did you eventually, how did that canoe tip? How did you realize, like, oh, I actually want to be doing comedy for a career?
Well, I had a lot of, not a lot of success, but I was doing fairly well by, you know, for the amount of time I could devote to comedy as a lawyer. I was, you know, I'd been on Harold teams, I'd been on Maude team, I was getting stuff published on McSweeney's. I felt I was hitting the limits of what I could do with my time and energy being
that's
a lawyer.
Lot of success, I would say.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I, yeah. And I, it was enough for me to make me think, I bet if I didn't, if I wasn't a lawyer, I could devote more and make a living out of this. Mm-hmm. And that's, and I'd always wanted to do that, really. And at the same time in my law firm career, I'd begun reaching the fourth year, which is the point at which you become a mid-level associate. Okay. And when you're sort of expected to drop everything else in your life and be a lawyer. Like, you need to have people under you. You need to start fixing their mistakes. So the law firm was basically telling me, you need to stop everything else and do this. And we expect really big things of you once you kind of, you know, abandon the rest of your life and focus more on this. And at that point, it was a decision, and I just made the jump to comedy.
Okay.
Which I thought would be very much disliked by all the partners. I thought they would consider me, like, very silly and foolish, but I went to every one of them, and, like, to a person, I would say, I just have this dream. I've always wanted to be a comedian. I've always wanted to write, and I just got to follow it. You know, I'm not getting younger, and I just want to follow this dream. And every one of them would say something like, you know, Zubin, I wanted to be a bass player in college, and then I went to law school. Follow your dreams. Like, every one of them. It turns out, like, every lawyer over 50 has some deep regret over a life that wasn't fulfilled, and so they're all very encouraging. So.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah,
so they're sad.
Yeah. Very sad, yeah, very sad. There's a lot, like, the
it's
law
not
firm.
Sad. Fuck those people. I'm glad they're sad. Well, sorry, Zubin. I know they're your coworkers.
The legal profession has, like, a lot of like, a huge percentage of them, like, 80% don't like their jobs, don't like their careers. So
yeah.
It's a lot of regret.
Good.
A lot of regret, yeah.
Good. They should have regret.
Did the lawyer hurt you in some way?
I don't know. I don't like the stories you're telling about it. Insurance companies and lawyers are not necessarily evil by any stretch, but enough of them are that when in doubt, I'm going to assume that until proven otherwise.
You know, those right. Hurricane Katrina victims could have read the contracts more carefully. You know? Like, you sign a contract, you're bound by it.
I mean, yeah, I heard Spike Lee say the same thing in a lot of interviews. Yeah. That's what his documentary is about. A lot of people don't realize that. Spike Lee was not on the side of the victims.
Yeah,
the
no,
victims.
It's vicious. Yeah. A lot of they deserve
it's a
this.
Lot of
yeah.
legalese and a lot of respect for contracts and rule of law.
Yeah, you can't have a civilization otherwise.
So
that's
much
right.
of those closing credits are fine print.
Yeah. Yeah. Closing credits starts at the 45-minute mark. Goes for like another hour. Good bit.
Yeah. That was a. Can somebody keep track of the number of good bits we do and the grades of bits? Just
Keaton, that's a bit. You grade them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So
man, I love this Keaton guy.
Sorry, Cypher.
And what was the amount of time between you making that decision and getting hired for The Daily Show?
Incredibly, very fortuitously small.
That's what I remember it as being. Yeah.
I left my law firm job in 2010, I think in June of 2010, mm-hmm. and I was hired as The Daily Show writer in May of 2011. Mm-hmm. So not even really a year, which I have Hallie Hagland to thank for, who was also on Reynard with
That's
me.
Right. That's right.
And this is a real testament to like the how much UCB didn't save my life, but really you know created a new life for me, new careers. That I had met Hallie on a on Reynard, and after that disastrous end of that run and how bad it was, I remember thinking like. This is going to be the worst shame of my life. I'll probably never look back on this with anything but just sadness and regret and bitterness. But becoming friends with Hallie and staying in touch with her and being friends with her led to her to recommend me for a writing job for the show. And, you know, there was a lot of other submissions to go through, but she was the door.
Yeah. Well, you've mentioned two teams that we described, Reynard and then as one of the worst teams ever. Which that's not a completely fair thing to say, but like certainly not didn't work as a Herald team.
Sure.
And then the Bishop, which didn't work. But that's two all of our most of our most successful alumni come from those teams.
That's true.
That's very true, actually.
Zubin and Hallie write for The Daily Show. Josh Patton for The Bishop writes for SNL. Mm-hmm. Christine Nangle, SNL former SNL writer, was on Hornado, another team that was sort of underachieving relative to the people on it.
Yeah.
Also was Dan Gerwich, like head writer for not head writer, but one of the senior writers at College Humor. Mm-hmm. One of the tickets to success should be get on a bad Herald team at UCB.
Yeah, let that bitterness and resentment just drive you to success. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah,
you've mentioned this a lot, and it seems like you are very, I don't know if consumed is the right word, but you seem to think a lot about your failures and your like resentments.
I'm definitely driven, I think, a lot by bitterness and jealousy.
Is that right?
Yeah.
I think that's, and I don't think it's in a healthy way that I'm driven by it. I don't. For example, I think that whenever you when your friends are successful around you, I think it's good to have a little bit of jealousy if it's motivating. And if it drives you to do better work, to do more work, there's definitely the kind of, you know, there's definitely kind of jealousy that curdles and just makes you quit and just bitch and not really do anything. Mm-hmm. But having a healthy sense of competition and that's fueled by jealousy, that why, you know, I could do that too. And not in, like, and there's a difference, I guess. Seeing one of your friends succeed, there's a difference between thinking, oh, I can do that.
Right.
And thinking they shouldn't have gotten that.
Right, right, right.
That's the difference. Right. That's the world of difference in there.
I think that is a big part of it right there, is that focal shift from, like, why did that person get that? I should have gotten that. They shouldn't have gotten that. To, oh, I want to do that. I can do that. You know?
Yeah.
I think that's what, like, that's the healthy way of interpreting. This is something that I'm just learning. But that's, like, the healthy way of interpreting jealousy is, like, oh, I'm jealous because I want to do that.
Yeah.
And I should be able to do that too.
And I think also, and this is, I might be projecting this, but I think that especially with improvisers, but with all artists to some degree, but with improvisers especially, their psyche, you know, to describe it would be almost like a very thin candy shell of ego and arrogance that surrounds a very thick layer of insecurity that itself surrounds an even thicker core of arrogance and ego. Because I think that to whatever extent, you know, improvisers can say that, you know, oh, I didn't think I'm good enough for this. I don't think I'm ready for this. You wouldn't do this art form, which is such a risky art form that yields such immediate shame and humiliation, if you didn't think in your core, I can do this.
Right.
So seeing what you consider your peer group and your friends succeed, I think naturally, you know, feeds that ego in the sense of you thinking, I can also do that. I'm as good as this person is. I can also do that. I should do more work, better work, because I can get to that level. Mm-hmm. As long as you avoid that trap of thinking, they're not good.
Right.
This is unfair. This world is unjust. Mm-hmm. Fuck all this. And that just leads you to, you know, not do anything. That just leads you into resentment and bitterness and not mm-hmm. Any sort of – I'm interchanging bitterness here when I'm saying it. But there's the curdling type of bitterness and the motivating type of bitterness. Mm-hmm. And I think I'm very much motivated by seeing other people do things, do great things, be lauded for them, myself being proud of them for doing it, but still thinking I can also do that. Why don't I also do that?
Right. So it's good to be able to have those feelings if you can have them in like a healthy kind of motivating way.
I think so. I mm-hmm. frankly, I don't know what else motivates people.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I guess the sheer joy of creating the art, I guess.
I think some people are that well adjusted. I can't picture it though.
I guess so, yeah. I'm sure.
Have you always been that way? Have you always had those kinds of feelings of like being able to like have kind of jealousy towards other people but interpreting it as a motivating factor? Can you remember other aspects in the history of your life of being like that?
I think,
like, where do you think that comes from? Is what I'm asking.
I don't know. I think I have two younger brothers, and they're very good at what they do. They're both incredibly successful, and I think there's like a natural sense of competition between us.
Are they the Gallagher brothers in Oasis?
Yes, yeah, they are. Uh-huh. Yeah, they're incredible. You know, so it's very hard to try and compete. No, we're a family that I think is very.
What do they do?
My younger brother is in Chicago politics. He's
Rahm Emanuel.
He's Rahm Emanuel right now, right? Yeah, he works for the mayor.
He changes. He's like
he's a shapeshifter.
Yeah,
but he's a brilliant. He's brilliant. He's very smart. He's very and not just brilliant in the sense of book smarts, but he's also very sharp, very street smarts.
Mm-hmm.
And my younger brother is an MD PhD candidate in at Vanderbilt right now.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And he's, you know, the NIH has completely funded his scholarship. He is, you know, destined for, you know, to be a major researcher and clinical doctor. That's not a real thing. A clinical researcher, I think.
Right, right, right.
But so I think it's growing up, there's like a very sense of like a competition among the three of us, which I think is sort of nurtures that kind of healthy you know, they're my brothers. They're doing successful. But because I'm their brother, I should also be able to do this. Right. I'm, you know, we're all, you know, the same genes. There's no reason I can't do what they're doing. I think that probably translates to the rest of everything I do.
When did you in your life first have to deal with failure? Sounds like you were a smart kid, went to college, went to law school, which must have meant you had confidence in yourself academically. You're doing short form, which must have meant you felt like you were smart and probably were smart. Probably came from a family where there was a lot of success expected and you're doing it. So when did you first have to deal with humbleness?
Reynard, frankly. Like, Reynard
that
was...
That late, really?
Reynard, well, because up to that point, you know, law school... You can't... I mean, once you get into a law school, it's very hard to fail in law school.
Yeah.
Like a lot of these professional schools, especially law school, once you're kind of there, if you do well... and if you're in Georgetown or one of these top law schools, then at least when I was there, jobs kind of come to you.
Okay.
Now it's much more difficult because the economy's collapsed. But up until that point, especially comedy-wise, I had nothing but success. I was the best person in my high school improv team. I'm one of the best. I was one of the top of my college. This is all my own opinion, obviously. I mean, I'm very. Right.
But you felt that way, and you had enough validation to feel comfortable in these things.
Yeah, you know, with the UCB classes, I felt like I'm really good at this. I can do this well. Up to Reynard, when it was just, you know, every, you know, almost every performance of Reynard was disastrous. I personally felt it was the biggest hit to my own ego. I never sensed failure at something that I loved so much as I did with Reynard.
So that must have
and
been
good
like,
people at Reynard.
Great people at Reynard, yeah.
That must have been a huge thing for you to go through, to suddenly hit this point where you're like, you achieve this goal, and then it's like, I'm failing now.
Oh, completely, yeah. Uh-huh. No, it was very shocking.
How did you deal with that?
I'm badly, you know, but I mean, I think, you know, and to some extent, like everybody, you know, I mean, once an improv team begin to hit like a, begin to start questioning your team's competence, you begin to also question the team chemistry, cliques begin to form within your team, you begin to blame people on your team,
yeah.
Completely unjustified.
That's the narrative of like all
completely.
Struggling
Harold
teams.
Once you hit that debt spiral, then there's no real way to pull out. I don't think there's any real way to pull out of it. There's just too much poison begins to develop.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how, you know, I certainly dealt with Reynard, much to my discredit, much to, I think, everybody's discredit on the team that began like backbiting and sniping at each other.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, I guess that's sort of like the natural part of a failure is there's a moment when you just sort of you blame everything else, and then ultimately you trying to learn the lesson of what you personally did wrong,
mm-hmm.
and then you adjusted that, or you don't ever learn that lesson. You just keep blaming everybody else, and then you just sort of sink.
So what did you think you personally did wrong? Like, what did you take?
Oh no,
from
I didn't.
That?
I'm sorry, I didn't fail.
Oh, okay.
I should be specific. I think what I like personally, I have a tendency as an improviser to be very to try and to control scenes, mm-hmm. to be a captain of a scene,
mm-hmm.
And that came out very much so as it came down.
That's a problem of a lot of new Harold teams when it's everybody's first team.
Yeah,
because you were like the alpha in your class, probably not you specifically, but if you were good enough to make Harold Night, you were probably somebody who made a lot of decisions in class and made a lot of choices in class shows. So then you get put on a team with seven other people who were good at that. And it's almost like everybody leads, you know?
Yeah, completely. And no one wants to listen.
And improv is about listening and mimicking somebody else's – or building on somebody else's idea. But it's a subtle but important – I've observed this at least. Like a lot of people's first teams, it's a lot of bossing.
Yeah.
And then then you see everybody's second team and it's like – somebody who's middle-aged and is on their second marriage, where it's like, right. Well, yeah, we'll figure it out.
Yeah.
they're like way more chill.
Yeah, and that's like that's definitely my problem is to just demand that the scene follow what I wanted to follow, regardless of what your idea for the scene was.
Yeah.
Right.
So that was my own personal contribution, one of the contributions I had to Reynard's failure.
when you think about the good things of Reynard, there must have been. Were there any scenes that you did that still stick out as like that was a great scene or that was a great group game? You have no positive associations.
There's one scene that I remember being like the worst scene. I don't know if it's worth saying.
Sure.
It was our last show, and it was like it was the it was. Just
Kevin Hines gave you notes after the show, I think.
Did he?
I think that's right.
I think, yeah, boy. I think a lot of those notes are just blurs. We had a lot of guests, like Chris Gethard gave us notes, Kevin Hines gave us notes. A lot of them were just like.
I think I coached your last practice.
Oh, really? Yeah, maybe. Oh, yeah, I think you did. That's right. That's
we
right.
didn't know it was your last practice at the time.
Yeah, no. Although there was like this sense, I think, of the team that.
Yeah,
the,
it was a broken play. Although everyone was like pretty nice. I mean, like, one thing is, it's interesting to see groups that aren't working, I think, because like everyone was individually very talented and like super on board, like worked hard.
Yeah.
Showed up for things.
So Zubin, Hallie Haglin.
Oh, here we go. We never do this right.
Aaron Glazer. Mm-hmm. Rob Cuthill.
Will Story.
Will Story.
Amber Petty.
Yes.
Right?
Yep.
From the get-go,
yep.
I think.
Oh, so yes. More. She was the only senior member on that
yeah.
team. Right.
Yeah.
I'm blanking on the last.
Spike Friedman.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. He's now in Seattle running a very successful theater company out mm-hmm. there and writing yeah. for Grantland.
Yeah.
Right. And John Adam, who is.
That's right.
Yeah,
John
yeah.
Adam. Yeah. Okay. Okay. So,
all great.
Yeah. Individually great, funny people.
All great, funny people.
People.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. So you were talking about this.
It was. I only bring this up because there's something specific about it. But we basically, it was a disastrous show from the beginning. It was the show that was our last show. Ultimately, we got cut the next morning. That night, I think actually, Anthony sent us out an email like 1 a.m. that night, being like, "You guys are done."
Like that's the nightmare of every team, where it's like that show is so bad, we're gonna get cut immediately. But everyone's like, "That doesn't happen." But it did
no,
happen
no, it did.
To you guys.
Absolutely did.
But how long had you guys been together at that time?
8 months, I think. It was they cut us like 2 months before auditions. They didn't even want to give us like 2 months. Like, forget it. And like, rightfully so. It's like, it's just not fair to the people paying, you know, $0 to come see. It was very, very, it was very bad.
So talk about the scene.
But it was, I don't remember much of the scene, but it was Rob Cuthill had, basically was as, it was Rob Cuthill and Hallie Haglin were in a forest of some sort. And Rob Cuthill basically summoned various animals, one of which was Clopper, which was a horse, and one of which was Hopper, which was a rabbit. And I don't know why they came out or how they came out, but in the second beat of the scene, again, like it was... They're back in the forest, but there's a hedge that was dividing, like a tall row of hedges that were dividing the stage in half. So I don't know why there was, but Rob then said, I'm going to need someone to jump over this hedgerow. Clopper, come out. And I don't know for what I understood, but the guy playing the rabbit came out instead.
Because uh-huh. he's expecting to jump right. over hedge. Why right. would you ask yeah, for yeah. a horse
yeah,
if you have a rabbit?
Yeah. I guess he was thinking the horse would jump. I'm not quite sure, yeah. But Rob called for Clopper. The guy playing
Hopper
came out instead. And Rob sees Hopper come out and goes, and this in this resigned, completely meta, fourth wall broken tone, just goes, "Oh, I was hoping for Clopper." I only remember this because, like, 2 years later, at the Daily Show, we were trying to like figure out like names for horses for some reason.
Yeah.
And Hallie was in the room with me, and I kind of just like, I kind of turned to her and I was like, do you remember Clopper? And she immediately goes, "God, I was just thinking." Like 2 years later, it still like burns. That's like when I think about right now. And I think about Clopper and Hopper. That's my takeaway from
that. Oh, man.
I'm sorry. Yeah, I don't have any success stories.
That's okay. That's
any
okay.
diamonds in that. You know.
I want to shift to Maud Night for a little bit, if that's okay.
Sure.
We can talk about Thunder Gulch.
I approve.
Yeah.
You were on Thunder Gulch. I had the pleasure of directing you guys for about a year.
And I would say, and I don't mean to make this a circle jerk or anything, but I think that was Thunder Gulch's golden era is when you were directing
Thank
us.
You.
You were an incredible director.
Thank
the team
you.
Really took off when, mm-hmm. when you were there.
I hope people that are working on sketch shows are listening to this.
No, you should. Yeah, there's no money that you can't – it's not worth paying John Frusciante. But he'll take $10, which is amazing. He won't take any more.
That is,
yeah.
That's
you can hackle him down to $10 no matter what he says.
So I think Thunder Gulch was a great Mod team.
It was. Thunder Gulch also was a really happy team.
Yes.
Yes.
Like one of these playful – it's weird. I think Thunder Gulch could have off shows and shake them off and be like happy. You know what I mean? Or like disappointing sketches or something. But there was enough success in its history and enough of a core confidence in itself to be like – Thunder Gulch felt – happily sloppy sometimes, mm-hmm. you know?
Yeah.
Well, I think there was...
Not, I don't mean that in a bad way. I mean like in a... They're going to tumble down the stairs mm-hmm. and it's going to work and they'll have fun.
Yeah.
From the inside, you know, my biased kind of perspective, I agree with that. I think like... It was just so much like camaraderie on Thunder Gulch and so much like
Cuthill,
silly love for each other.
Yeah, Cuthill is one of the silliest people ever. Everything
Rob
he says... Makes
oh
me
God,
laugh,
yeah.
and
I'm such a
he
huge
looks
fan
crazy.
Of Rob
Cuthill. I mean, VC used to be comedy videos. Cuthill's in a million of them because everybody who ever meets him says, "I want to put him in a video," because he just the way he walked in the room with a bagel, went over to the corner, and seemed to just stand there lost, made me laugh. Or something. Yeah. He's always doing something that seems hilarious.
So funny. Not hilarious.
Yeah.
He's got such a specific voice and tone to his being.
Yeah.
I just want to be around it all the time, and I want the world to...
Thundergolds was full of ridiculous people. Yeah. Was Chris Schell and Alex Gardelis writing for
another ridiculous human being.
Chris Schell makes Cuthill look like Liam Neeson in terms of silliness. Chris Schell is maybe the most ridiculous man I've met.
Yeah.
I don't think he's a human being. I think he's somebody from Toontown. He's from Toontown, just like with a little skin paint on him, hiding.
Yeah, Cody Lindquist, who's great. Yeah, Shannon O'Neill.
Was Santangeli on Thunder Gulch? Or he just
directed us for a while.
Yeah. That's a good fit. Oh yeah, Shannon O'Neill was on Thunder Gulch.
Yeah, Leslie Mizell, who's amazing and also a ridiculous human being,
and on the Rockets.
Mm-hmm.
And
what I want to talk about.
A lot of everyone else in Thunder Gulch too. But everyone was so great.
Right. Yes, I want to talk specifically about you because this is something that I always notice about you, and I have talked about, and will still talk about from time to time. Is I think your presence and abilities as a straight man were one of the best. I think you're one of the best straight men at the theater.
I'm very flattered by that. I take that really well. Thank you very much.
Maybe I'm biased, but like. Your ability to, and this also comes out in like when you're just like, you know, doing bits or doing improv scenes as well, like your ability to ground ridiculous philosophies in like a straight man tone is really admirable, you know, and it like it makes scenes. Like one of my favorite Thundergolds sketches, Chili Dog Mountain, the most ridiculous.
That's like an 80s movie parody, right?
Yeah, and you played the straight character in that scene, just like grounding the idea that you were a man that always wanted to have his honeymoon at an 80s ski resort.
Yeah.
What, now that I'm done jerking you off and circle jerking you with my praise, how much of that are you conscious of? What are you doing in those moments? Like, is there something that being the straight man appeals to you about? Like,
I love being the straight man in a scene. Like, I think that's my strength as both a sketch performer and an improviser. I think that I would say that the what I try to bring to a sketch definitely as a straight man is both a sense of dignity, the kind of which I think I would like to think I convey. I think I probably look a bit more serious than the average comedian. But more importantly, I think that I think there's a lot of sketch straight acting, which is very hammy in a way.
Mm-hmm.
When someone does a crazy move, there's a tendency for a lot of sketch people to sort of overreact to it. And just
I think that's true.
Yeah.
Especially on Mod Night, I think, because there's not a lot of rehearsal time. Mm-hmm. So like you haven't had time to rehearse it in a subtle way and get confidence that the subtle performance will be enough to carry it, mm-hmm. I think.
Yeah.
So then you're out there performing it maybe for the third time ever. If one line doesn't hit, I think there are sometimes an understandable but maybe destructive tendency for everybody to like ham it up to try to like land the rest of the sketch.
Yeah.
Like sketches totally tend agree. To skew broad mm-hmm. a lot on Mod Night. It's
completely,
hard to combat that.
Yeah. And I think that's a real death for a straight character because you have to give the crazy character all the juice.
Yeah.
So to speak of the comedy juice.
That's a totally technical and used term.
That has to be given to them.
Yeah.
And if it's your job to ground the scene in the reality, it needs to require the subtlety that someone who is encountering this craziness for the first time would. The disbelief, the slow building of
yeah, completely realizing. Invested.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I think that's one of the things that I see in you is that investment and that like that ability to – there's something I wanted to say about – oh, this ability to like believe – to yes and basically that craziness, to believe fully in the idea that this is happening in the world. There's no like, wait a minute, what the fuck? There's like this kind of like, I agree that this is existing in this universe.
Yeah.
And it's also very unusual.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. I think if you don't have that kind of investment and reality, then the sketch suffers.
Mm-hmm. And what's interesting is that you're talking about giving like the unusual character all the comedy juice, which I think is true. And also, I remember your straight character roles either as fondly or more fondly than some of the unusual character roles.
I think it's why Stickles takes your face and puts it on a pack of kittens all the time.
Yeah, that's actually probably
you
why.
Are the straight man in the Photoshop.
Yeah,
yeah.
Like, I remember the again. My pool of memories is all from Thunder Gulch sketches, but I'm thinking of the John Cougar Mellencamp sketch again, another sketch that Sean Skordelis wrote. It was about the recording of Jack and Diane, and the original lyrics were all just filthy. Like, instead of sucking on chili dogs, it was Rob Cuthill as John Mellencamp singing sucking on penises outside the Tasty Freeze.
Yeah.
And Jubin played the recording engineer who had to keep stopping him and saying, like, this will never make it on the air. It's
too dirty. Yeah.
And your reactions to that, your, like, fully invested, believing reactions were, like, just as funny as Rob's Mellencamp.
Thank you. A lot of that is writing, though. Sean Skordelis are really good
that's
writers.
True. Yeah, that's very true.
I think with sketch writing, especially, like, the straight man, you know, has to be written as well as the crazy person, or else, you know, like, if the straight man is just constantly sitting there saying, like, that's crazy, this can't happen.
So how do you fix that?
Well, I think both writing and improvising, the sketch, I remember, like, Dominic Dirkus once put it in a really good way, saying the job of the straight man is to build the train tracks as the train is hurtling towards him. In the sense that you have to keep guiding the crazy person towards something instead of just standing there, like, saying, this is ridiculous, what you're doing can't be done. For example, like, with that Sean Skordelis sketch, which was well written, it wasn't, you know, the straight man wasn't just – the recording guy wasn't just saying, stop doing this. This is crazy. He kept saying, try and shift it more – you know, we're trying to get this younger audience. We're trying to get more like a homespun audience. Try, you know, recall memories of, like, you know, being at, you know, the Tasty Freeze and drawing like a hot dog, which gives him, you know, more avenues to then, you know, to tip that direction and faint the other way.
Yeah. Okay, I like that train track metaphor.
Yeah.
I'm going to name different – motifs, and you express the same metaphor in those motifs.
Okay, sure.
So now explain that metaphor. I'll give you in terms of basketball.
Sure.
How's the straight man in basketball?
The straight man in basketball is building the basketball court as the guy's driving to the basket.
Good. All right. How about in terms of snowmen?
The straight man is building the snowman. As the crazy guy is running towards it with a carrot.
How about in terms of the Hulk?
The straight man is the gamma rays giving the Hulk the juice to become the Hulk. It's all to whatever extent the straight man is helping the Hulk be the Hulk.
How about in terms of McDonald's?
The straight man is ordering at McDonald's.
How would it be different at Burger King?
I don't have a metaphor for that.
All right, well, your question, John.
Great.
Your witness?
I'm glad we now have two podcasts mentioning Burger King in a row.
Oh, that's right, yeah.
A new tradition.
Oh, no.
No, please. I am advocating against that.
No, but.
That tradition. All right. I don't have any other questions.
Jubin, what do you think? How was the Bishop was a happier time, right?
It definitely was up until, like, the death spiral began again, I would guess. Yeah.
How long did that take for that death spiral?
It was like two or three, but more weeks, I think, than the Reinhardt. No, the Bishop was definitely like the Bishop's disbanding was a little bit of a surprise to me. I didn't think we deserved it. I recognized afterwards that, like, there had to be room cut. I didn't think that we were bad. We definitely didn't gel the way I wanted to, or I was hoping to. But it was for most of us. Not for most of us. Now I think about it, it was me and Nangle, and Will Story were the three.
Yeah, everyone else was new. Tony Rodriguez was new. Stickles, Bozarth. I'm gonna forget people. Yeah,
and eventually Josh Patton, who joined in afterwards.
Yeah, I'm sure we're forgetting somebody. But yeah, was Tim Martin ever on the Bishop? No.
Tim Martin was on. Martin got on. I want to say
Batman.
Was he on Batman the first?
He was put on Batman. I can't remember if that was
his first Herald team.
I think it was.
I think it was. Yeah, that's an interesting, like, aspect of how, you know, like, there's so much, I don't say luck necessarily, but it is kind of just, if you get put on a team that has great people but the chemistry doesn't work, then that really just kind of messes you up for a while. You know,
yeah.
It's hard to overcome that, a lack of chemistry. You can't build on that. And sometimes you get very lucky, you get put on a great team. Ragnarok, I think, was very successful. The team right before the Reinhardt audition was put together was Bastion.
Right.
You know, a legendary team. And sometimes it's just, you know, like how that happens. It's unfortunate in that, you know, sometimes it just doesn't work. And if it doesn't work, then it's not a black mark on your, you know, on your record. I think
it's more like a psychological thing to get over, like to recover your confidence.
It really is, yeah.
I've done improv for a million years, and a bad show still shakes me. Like a bad show, the next day I walk around thinking like, well, I'm no good at this.
Yeah,
me too.
And I've got a lot of reference points of validation that get me through it, but that's hard to. It took a long time.
Yeah, but it's...
And if your first bunch of validation is sort of... your first experience is sort of... I mean, improv is a roll of the dice... And it's a group sport. No one person can turn it around. It's hard.
Exactly. Yeah. It's very much psychological damage that you have to sort of overcome with you know in any kind of failure like that, especially as big in this community as having a Herald team be disbanded. Mm-hmm. That's sort of like the biggest. I think in our community the biggest sort of marker of I guess public shame you can think of.
It isn't meant to be that way, but it feels that way.
It's not meant to be, absolutely, but it definitely feels that way. I remember like the weeks after Reynard, I was thinking like, should I even come to the theater? Like, is it too embarrassed? I actually remember like the week after Reynard got disbanded, I was going to Herald Night, and I remember like just standing outside the door for just a second, being like, is this really just like, is it just too embarrassing? And Eddie Dunn. Was standing outside, who at that point I think had been cut from like three or four Herald teams.
Yeah. Right.
And he just looks at me with this goofy smile. He's like, hey, you keep your head up. that meant like so much.
That wasn't Eddie Dunn. That was a ghost.
Yeah.
Who like took the form of an angel who took the form of Eddie Dunn.
I honestly think that's what Eddie Dunn is. I think it's an angel that's taken a human form as Eddie Dunn.
Well, he's naked and Unbreakable Gun and there's no genitals.
Yeah.
So I think he might be a seraphim.
That's like Eddie Dunn's just role in this world is to just make other people feel good.
Yeah. And it definitely, like he was just joking, but it meant everything to me.
Sure.
That moment. I was like, fuck that. If Eddie Dunn is telling me,
you keep your head up.
Keep going. Especially in that way. It was like, you keep your head up. And this guy winked.
Hey, you keep your... Oh, I can't do it anymore.
It was great.
You're getting further away from it.
You keep your head up!
That's it. You got it.
You keep your head up!
What was I going to say? I had three questions in my head at the same time.
So you were for The Daily Show. How has your UCB experience prepared you, and what did you have to learn separately? Do you know what I mean? Like, in what moments are you like, oh, I'm glad I... Because of having done stuff at UCB, I'm well ready for this moment. At what moment do you like, this is a skill that I have to develop kind of new or whatever?
I think the skill that that I did not quite have going to the show that I've worked on is, and I think maybe stand-up helps this skill a bit more, is coming up very quickly with like one-line jokes.
Yeah.
With like, I not necessarily like set up punchline stuff, but just very quickly coming up with a nice riff
or a joke of
something. Yeah, a turn of phrase. I think I'm very good at taking someone's joke and adding to it, or helping find a button for it, agreeing with it, and heightening it, which is also very important. I think definitely the understanding that, you know, all the writers are working together. There's no, you know, competition. I don't feel a sense of competition with none of us feel competition with each other, which I think is might not be true of other writing jobs, but the Daily Show, it's all very fun and everyone's very friendly, and we all worked on it to improve each other's jokes, which I think is a very critical skill that improv definitely taught me.
Yeah, to be excited and motivated to help somebody else's thing be better.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Like, to not worry about how it breaks down credit wise. You just want the joke to be good.
Yeah, and to also not to value your own idea too much. If your own, because you know, so many every day, like you have like 6-7 ideas that don't go anywhere.
Yeah,
as a writer and. You know, in improv, learning that idea of like, I had an idea, but this is the new idea. This guy had this and this turned this way, so this is what it is now. Mm-hmm. Definitely comes to like, you know, learning how to kill your darlings. And learning also that your darlings aren't as darling as you think they are. Like, no one else, you know, like what you think is, you know, is comedy gold is not good.
Yeah.
And learning that is, I think improv helps you learn that.
Yeah.
In a way that I don't know if stand-up necessarily does. I think you might get a little bit more attached to your...
It's all yours. Sure. Much further along in the development process.
Yeah.
Like pretty far upstream, it's not yours anymore in improv.
Yeah. Any kind of solo writing endeavor, I think you kind of cultivate your darlings a little bit more.
Yeah.
It's harder to like get rid of them.
I think improv definitely, like telling a joke and having it met with immediate silence is the fastest way to learn, like, oh, I'm not as funny as I think I am. That joke is not as good as it was in my head, so...
Right,
you know,
and my individual joke is not as funny as our collaborative moves and jokes.
You know how you were talking about on we were talking about hamming it up too much on Mod Night or something like that, like trying to counteract that. Like, I feel like going from an environment where you're doing a lot of improvising and sketch acting into a pure writing environment in The Daily Show, which is all the setups are real life things, and a lot of the takes have a point, you know? Like, we have a point, and we're trying to express that point in a humorous way. Like, I would wonder if, like, you get the hamminess beat out of you in a way. Like, if like, the thing you're talking about, like, being serious, being invested, taking... How am I trying to put this? I feel like if someone's done a lot of improv, you learn the power of, like, confidence and, like, being... and, like, a swaggering approach and fearlessness, but you're sloppy. Like, there's not, like, you don't rewrite, you know? So there's no precision. You got to get, like, 80% of the way there. Your Eddie Dunn impersonation can be like this. Like, that's close enough. But, like, if you're writing and it's prepared, it's got to be more specific and precise.
Yeah, no, that's true. Like, brevity and precision in joke writing, become a lot more important. And I think that's something that sketch definitely helps you learn.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like I see stand-ups make the jump to writing more often because they're punished more for imprecision and sort of sloppy word use.
Yeah, and you go home.
The medium punishes you more often than improv will.
Yeah, because absolutely. And you get to go home and be like, all right, why didn't this work?
I'll try it again tomorrow.
Whereas
improv, your acting is more... Right. Tested. It's like, well, you better be invested and confident or the audience is going to smell it.
Yeah. And also in improv, you talk more in terms of, or at least this is my experience, that we talk more in terms of we after shows than I. It's like, oh, what could we do better next week?
Yeah, there's the cult of the
show,
group, like, rather than the cult of the individual.
Like, maybe we can, you know, like, not rush into the scenes or into the opening so much or this or that. Whereas with stand-up, it's like, all right, I have to get better at writing and delivery.
Right.
Yeah, it's very, I mean, and these are blind spots of improv, in terms of the skills that it teaches you to be a writer and to get paid to write. It's good, you know, to do other comedic endeavors besides improv, stand-up, sketch writing, that kind of thing, to help fill in the blind spots. Because, improv, it really doesn't teach you to, like, develop and craft and precisionize your material.
Yeah.
For example, you know, you use words like precisionize instead of the actual word. But that definitely is a blind spot in improv, which is why I would say, like, people who want to do comedy for a living should do stuff besides just improvising.
Mm-hmm. This is related to what we were talking about before, but you got hired for The Daily Show and you still continued to be on Mod Night. How did you balance that out? Because I was always impressed. I was like, why is this guy still here?
Yeah, he's going to tell us all to fuck off. And
mostly it was because I loved Thunder Gulch. Thunder Gulch is such a great team. It's so fun. It was definitely like a lot of work to add on to it, but I thought it was worth it for the team. Like, I really, really loved it.
And I guess you'd already been living such an insane schedule.
It wasn't much of a change. That too. Yeah. It didn't really require, if anything, the hours were like less now.
Yeah.
Because once the show is taped, it's done. I can leave. It's not like I have four more hours of brief writing to do afterwards.
Right.
So that was, it was surprisingly less difficult than you would think.
Okay.
The hours are, I know, like SNL, for example, the hours there are much more difficult to have like a nightlife.
Mm-hmm.
But The Daily Show's hours are a lot more conducive to having like other stuff at night.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You're also, we haven't really mentioned this, an incredibly smart person, I think.
Like, oh, thank you.
Very, well-read.
I don't get that.
Yeah, I don't get that impression.
Really?
That's not coming off.
When I see Zubin, I'm like, well, this fucking dummy is lucking out. That's one thing I say to myself a lot.
Wow. I'm trying to cultivate more of a smart air. And that's,
you don't seem like it to me. You seem like a buffoon. Like, I'm surprised to me whenever your pants are facing the right way.
Wow. And not around his ankles.
Yeah. Like, you've managed to get them up, you know.
I feel like I usually wear nice things, like sophisticated.
It's amazing.
Outfits.
I assume you have help, or you live in a hospice or something where people like dress you.
Okay, yeah. Should I wear glasses? Should I have?
I don't know. I think it's just some sort of fundamental part of your energy.
It's just
it
my aura.
Seems dumb.
I think you're in the death spiral of personas.
Whenever I've talked to you my whole life, I've always been like, this guy does not have it together. That's the first thing I say to myself. I'm like, this guy's a wreck.
That's fair.
Let's talk about BP Spills Coffee.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I feel like that's actually a place for a lot of people who maybe don't know Zubin have seen him because that video got such play.
Mm-hmm.
So this was a video that you helped write, right?
That's right. Yeah. And it was written by Eric Tenoy, Gavin Spieler,
a lot of people,
Eric Scott, and myself.
How? Well, that's a whole other thing. But Because I think Tanoi had the idea initially, but then everyone and everyone had their hands on that.
That's right. Yeah. Tanoi had the idea of like people at BP spilling something and not knowing how to clean it up, and then we like.
And you're a Halliburton in that, right, Jibin?
Yeah, I'm a very small part of that sketch. That was such a great sketch.
It makes me laugh. Like your entrance makes me laugh every time. I think it's like it's kind of like when the sketch goes, oh, this is a good idea, and it's like, oh, great, there's like a whole other leg that's going to happen. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think my memory of it is fuzzy, and I hope I'm not taking credit for something that wasn't me, but I remember wanting you to play that part specifically because like it was like serious kind of straight character.
I remember that you asked me and Rob Cuthill to come do it, and Rob was unable to because of a legitimate family thing. He wasn't able to come. Mm-hmm. And then as after we taped it, it started like blowing up. Like the three of us started like I started emailing you and him, just taunting about how wildly successful it is. Like people were just stopping us in the street, putting it on. Like it was so great we had the free time. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, what was your? Was there something specific you wanted to talk about?
I just wanted to bring up that he was in it, and that if people want to see Jubin being a really funny, befuddled straight man, that they can go to the Two-Thirds Market BP Spills Coffee and see him walk in as Halliburton and be like, "You guys can't pin this on us."
Yeah, the first 2 minutes just skip past it. Like it's all
that's not necessary. Yeah, cut right to when Jubin walks in and knocks over four more cups of coffee. Is that what you do?
Yes.
Yeah, I bump into
a Tanoi walks in with coffee and you knock that over. I don't know. I thought that was like really funny.
It was really funny.
I mean, it's far and away the most successful video that the New York UCB theaters ever made.
I guess so, yeah. It's just about 13 million hits.
I think that's right.
Yeah.
What?
I think.
Oh, we should do a reunion or something.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was shown.
It's the most successful thing I've ever done in my life next to this podcast.
Yeah, I mean, the only successful thing I've done besides watching that video is on the road, I make fun of Renard. I go on the road and I gather people in.
You make a lot of money on the lecture circuit doing that, right?
It's surprisingly how often I get booked for it. I'm going to Dusseldorf.
So just trash Renard?
Yeah.
over and over again?
Yeah.
Yeah, your PowerPoint presentation, that is very thorough.
It didn't start that way. I owe a lot to Al Gore for his help.
Do you feel
you're getting on like one of those like stepladder cranes up and down, all to explain the terrible of Raynard?
This is what what Lower Manhattan will look like after Raynard.
Yeah. A frog jumps into a Herald. The Herald's at room temperature. But by the time it's in the third beat, that frog doesn't know enough to get out.
Again, I really don't mean to like. Everybody in Raynard was great. Everybody was so good.
It's fun,
and they're all doing great things now. So
we're overstating how bad any Herald team can be, but I think it's fun.
Yeah,
and I'm going to continue to make that myth even bigger.
Do you still feel in some way like driven by that like failure or?
Absolutely.
Even now, like at
is that right? Because you know, you say that in an. I wonder because like I hear you say that, and it sounds funny, and I believe you that you put pressure on yourself, and that like you've, but like I think you're a pretty positive person. Like you're very like beloved by everybody who works with you. So I don't believe you really carry around the negative energy of someone who is truly motivated from a bitter place. Like I think those people are out there, but they tend to carry with them some more significant baggage than I think you have. Like, I think you're just ironically stating it.
Is it, like, I might be stealing your answer, but is it just that you have been able to process it in a healthy, you're able to, like a sort of, like, resentment alchemist, sort of being able to spin that lead into gold?
Well, yeah. I mean, I shouldn't say, I guess maybe resentment, bitterness isn't the right word for it, because, I don't consider myself, like, an angry,
you don't have that
person.
Right.
But I definitely think that, I definitely still keep trying to prove myself and want to prove myself to everybody, and I'm not satisfied with where even though I think where I am right now is like I'm at my dream job right now.
Yeah.
I think by any measurement of my own subjective measurement, and even I think objectively I could be, I'm very, very successful.
Right.
But it's still the sense of, and to some extent it's Raynard's failure. It's to some extent it's just like the natural drive of seeing other people in my peer group that I deeply respect and like being successful as well, that makes me want to prove myself to them.
Hmm. So can you walk me through a moment of this? Like, do you have like 3 a.m. anxieties or some equivalent of that where it's like, you know, crisis moments internally? I mean, everyone has these in some fashion to some degree. Like, oh, am I doing this the right way? Am I wasting time on this?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Every time I'm not, like, every moment that I'm not, you know, writing something or coming up with.
So what's your process to stop that from destroying you? Do you have a conscious one? Like, do you have any kind of, like, mental thing you walk through? I feel like everyone evolves some version of coping skills for their insecure moments.
Yeah, definitely. I think, well, one thing is, like, I remind myself that I've done a lot of great things so far, that I'm, you know, that I definitely like doing what I'm doing. If you had asked me this 2 years ago, when I just left my law firm, I was just sort of writing.
So let's talk about it at that point. Let's go back to that time.
At that point, yeah, in 2010, I had quit my job. I had just been disbanded from the Bishop, and I was just sort of jumping into this netherworld of not having any income for the first time in my life, not having any sense of where my career was going, because every job before then was. You know, my path at that point had been like, you know, college, law school, being a lawyer. It's a very risk-averse path. Mm-hmm. So that was a huge leap. And there was a lot of feeling there, especially that I didn't know what was going to happen to me. I didn't know where I was going to end up. And I think the coping mechanism for that is to really just trust that you are good enough to do it. And I think that's where the ego comes in. I think if you are a person who does this art, you are... by definition, someone who's very confident in your own power.
Yeah.
And I think the trick is to tap into that, to recognize that you do believe you're going to do it. You would quit otherwise.
Yeah.
Right.
Not to focus on the insecurity crust, but to go back into the core and make that conscious. Don't let that be the subconscious driving motivation. Let that be understood by you consciously that I'm doing this because I know I'm good enough to do it. And it's a matter of time before I'm recognized. And you know, there's always going to be the odds that that's not going to happen. That sometimes, you know, luck doesn't turn out that way, and you just run out of time, and you have to do something else. But if you just keep reminding yourself, I'm doing this because I know I'm good enough to do it, and that's how I definitely did it. I just kept reminding myself that I can do this. I'm funny. I'm talented. I have what it takes. You can drive past that insecurity. Mm-hmm. And still to this day, like I still think that. I see other people getting things, getting even jobs that I don't necessarily want. Mm-hmm. Still makes me, you know, like, oh, that's great they're there. Like, I should also be doing that. You know? Like, no, and again, and I don't mean this to say in any way that this isn't also driven by pride. I don't think being proud and happy for your friends is exclusive from being envious of them.
Right.
I think they're the exact same things. I can be very happy and very proud of having of my friends. Of, you know, for example, like, you know, Josh Patton becoming an SNL writer.
Yeah.
Of, you know, Christine Nangle being on, you know, on the Kroll Show. Of Nate Dermott becoming the artistic director. All these things.
Yeah.
I'm very happy for them. Very proud of them. At the same time, it motivates you. You know.
Yeah.
It makes me think like, oh yeah, people are making moves. I should be making moves. I should be doing things.
Right. Right.
Mm-hmm. I think yeah. I mean, to some extent. You know, maybe it's, you know, it's definitely you leave yourself open to a trap of just sinking into a hole.
Yeah, you have to be balancing that at all times.
Yeah.
Yeah, you have to be putting just as much energy into being proud of people as you are of being, like, driven by wanting to do those things.
Yeah, yeah.
Any other questions, Will?
No further questions.
I think that's a great place to leave it. Saifa, did you have any questions?
No. Keaton?
Keaton, right. Really?
Come on, Keaton.
Keaton, everybody loves you. You're like the heartthrob of the UCB podcast now.
He knows when to stay quiet. That's part of being loved.
That's the mystery. That's the mystery of you. Zubin, thank you.
Thank you, guys. Thank you for having me.
Thanks, Zubin.
Thanks so much.
I hope Stickles does a good Photoshop in celebration of this podcast.
Yeah, can I tell you, when I took a headshot photos with Alden Ford, like the great Alden Ford.
Mm-hmm. The great Alden Ford.
The great Alden
Ford. Do people say that?
I think
he's a magician.
He's a magician.
That's right.
Yeah. he used to be the incredible Alden Ford, but he kind of lost.
Didn't we spend the very first podcast raving about Alden Ford? Justin Tyler was on to promote some show, and we spent most of it talking about how kind of Renaissance man Alden Ford was. Because he does do like a million things super well.
So while I was doing the headshots with him, I said just a one impulse moment, like, oh, let's take a funny one.
Yeah.
And I took like a funny one of me like kind of like smirking like in a resigned way. And to my eternal shame.
That's the picture that Jessica uses.
That's the one she uses.
If you don't know, Jessica Stickles is a performer. She
and writer.
Yeah, performer and writer who lived here
brilliant
for a while.
Writer,
and very great.
So incredibly
did
funny.
Some great shows
one of
here.
My best friends too. Yeah. Like really, really great. Except for this thing. This one black mark on.
She moved out to Los Angeles. She lives in Los Angeles now.
Yeah.
And she will make a lot of of photoshopped images of Zubin's face in ridiculous situations.
I should have said that at the beginning of the
podcast. Every year she does the 12 days of Zubin's or more than that. She did like
31.
Where she will photoshop.
A lot of the Bishop people do counting. Josh Patton does his 31 days of Billy Joel costumes in October on his Twitter feed. And he does the Counting Crows and then Stickles. You guys are like a weird OCD comedy.
I don't know how that developed from our team, but yeah, that appears to be it.
But if you're not friends with Jessica Stickles on Facebook, friend her. So
please don't encourage her. Don't encourage this at all.
Encourage her immediately.
And if she's listening, please make a million more of those. I love them. Thank you, Zubin.
Thank you, guys.
And we can see you every Saturday at 10 o'clock at
every
UCB
Saturday
East.
At 10 o'clock at the UCB East.
And what I Did for Love. Anything else you want to plug?
And watch The Daily Show on Comedy Central.
All right.
Monday through Thursdays.
Will? Plugs? Any plugs?
No, I feel good. I mean, like, let's help New Orleans and the Katrina victims, because Zubin's old bosses aren't.
Maybe teach them to read contracts.
Okay, goodbye.
Goodbye. Goodbye, Saifa. Goodbye, Keaton.
Goodbye. Thank you.
It's Will Hines. I'm here. I think I'm ready to podcast. I am. Sorry. I think I'm ready.
It's becoming like a French play.
Yes, sure.
Can I tell you a mic?
Yeah. Hey, it's John Frusciante testing the microphone.
I'm ready to interview Zubin Parang.
And we're here with Keith Moon this afternoon.
What's up? You know, I think life is short, and you should enjoy it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you don't get caught up with all the stuff these shirts tell you. Play drums like you want to.
Okay. Are you concerned at all with the level of drinking drugging?
Yeah, not high enough.
You want it to be higher.
That's right. Well, I don't like worrying about boundaries, mate. I feel like, you know, you let yourself get boxed in one area, you'll be boxed in them all.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
Mm-hmm. I understand you just installed a new pool in your...
yeah, it should be great. Should be great. Keeping it full all times. And I've installed a special engine system to create an undertow in my pool.
Really? You think that's wise?
I do. And I'm also, instead of chlorine, using a mild anesthetic. So if one was to...
I don't think any of this is smart enough.
...gulp it, you'd be a bit sleepy.
So
if you was already sleepy...
Why would you do that?
Well, I think it's important to relax.
Uh-huh.
And so I want the pool to be relaxing. Anyway, I also feel, of my drug use, I prefer barbiturates and downers.
Yeah, this is not a good idea.
Of the family of drugs.
Understand somebody like you who's kind of naturally wild and
animated.
Yeah,
I'm trying to balance it out. You know, I thought you'd appreciate that.
I mean, I appreciate the idea.
A bit of moderation.
But I feel like moderation is the furthest thing from your daily activities.
That's true, mate. Yeah, you're right with that. Here's to that. Cheers.
Also, I just want to point out that halfway through this bit, I realized that you died of a drug overdose and not drowning in your pool. It was Mick Taylor from the Rolling Stones.
Yeah, I know.
Or
it's
Brian Jones.
But I was inspired by Brian Jones' death, which is why I set the pool up that way. I hope someday to die like Brian Jones. So I'm trying to make it happen. I've created a hedge maze in my backyard, and the only way out is into the deep end of my pool.
That makes no sense at all.
And it's downwardly sloped, so if I'm ever drunkenly stumbling about, the incline will bring me naturally to the deep end of my anesthetized pool.
You're definitely going to die.
Oh, that'd be great. What's up? Oh, yeah. This is the middle of a song.
Oh, yeah. Sorry to thank you for conducting this interview in the middle of Baba O'Reilly. I appreciate it.
Well, it's a long song, so it's okay.
I wrote. Yeah, we're conducting this interview during the violin solo, the fiddle solo.
Yeah, it's long, right? Well, Pete Townsend knows what he's doing. We'll turn the reins over
to
him a bit.
Teenage girls, he doesn't.
Oh, get it off it. One guy does one thing wrong. You think he's a good songwriter or not?
He's a great songwriter.
So leave it at that.
I hope to one day hear all of his songs on CBS Crime Drama.